Okay, is that better? Okay. Welcome to Random Review. This is a deja vu random review, just like December. We timed it perfectly just when you all could get out. It's time for a random review. So I'm glad so many of you were able to get here. I'm Connie Georgiou, and along with Deborah Goldenberg in the back there, we coordinate the Random Review program, which is sponsored by Friends of the Library. We also have several local sponsors. Grassroots Bookstore provides books for our reviewers, and Northwest Graphic Imaging makes our beautiful posters. Trader Joe's provides our lovely flowers, and as of today, we have an exciting new sponsor locally. Allen Brothers Coffee Roasters has provided the coffee today, so you have probably noticed it tastes much better than it ever has in the past. If you have friends who couldn't get out yet, this program, like all of our reviews, will be made into a podcast and be available at the library's website very shortly. I have one special announcement today, which is that the big book sale is coming along in 2 weeks, Friday the 21st through Sunday the 23rd, Friday night 6 to 9 p.m., Saturday 9 to 4 p.m., Sunday 10 to 4 p.m., with the very special addition that on Friday, the doors open from 4 to 6 only for Friends of the Library members. This is a wonderful opportunity. In the back of the room are three different kinds of forms on which you can join the Friends of the Library. You can also join that night right outside at the fairgrounds, and you can get in before anybody else at 4 o'clock. Also, we still need volunteers for the book sale. This is our biggest fundraiser of the year for Friends of the Library. Corrine Gobley is in the back there at that table, and she will be there to help you sign up for membership or for volunteering at the end of Random Review. Next month's review, I just want to let you know, Wednesday, March 12th is another wonderful one. Beth Rietveld, the retired director of the Women's Center at OSU, is going to be reviewing Louise Erdrich's book, The Round House. And today, moving on with our program, Tammy Ryder is here to introduce our speaker. Tammy is one of the librarians here and also a member of our Random Review Committee.
I'm introducing Maria Chavez Haraldson. She is a first-generation Latina to the United States, having received her U.S. citizenship in the year 2000. Her current position is with the Oregon Youth Authority, serving incarcerated youth statewide. Most recently, she worked at OSU as the Assistant Director for the Center of Latina Studies. She served Benton County children in foster care as the executive director of CASA, Voices for Children, which is the court-appointed special advocates. Maria obtained her bachelor's degree in human resources, a master's degree in public administration, and is currently a doctoral student with the goal of obtaining her PhD in leadership and change through Antioch University in the year 2015. Maria has worked and advocated for victims of crime for over 20 years, offered testimony in federal court for women held in bondage, and worked for the Oregon Judicial Department. She also worked as a mental health specialist and formerly the Crime Victims Unit Director for the Yamhill District Attorney's Office. Maria is a national international trainer for CWAG, which is the Central Western Attorney General's Conference, training foreign nationals, investigators, prosecutors, and judges on topics of victims' rights, trial and court advocacy, and judicial reform. She has served as a board member of the Oregon Crime Victim Law Center and spent 4 years on Oregon State University's Board of Visitors and Minority Affairs as an advisor to President Ray. She is a mother of four. She has 9 siblings and several adorable pets. Loves to cook and dance salsa and passionately addresses social justice issues with her husband, John Haroldson. Maria and the Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor's stories have recently been published in a book authored by OSU professor Kayla Garcia, which is the Latino and Latina Leaders of the 21st Century, Ordinary Beginnings, Extraordinary Outcomes, and it's put out by Florencanto Press. And I'd like to introduce Maria.
Good afternoon. If you can't hear me or if I start to drop my voice, just wave at me and that'll be the signal to bring it up a little bit. Thank you, Tammy, for that introduction. Thank you to Deborah Goldenberg and Connie Georgiou for inviting me to review this book. It really was a pleasure for me. I don't know if in my busy schedule I would have read it, but having accepted the invitation, I can't tell you how much I really, really enjoyed reading it. I listened to it on the audio on my way to work, and I also read the paperback version of it. So, of course, I had to see all the pictures that you couldn't really see on the audio. It was interesting for me to read the book because there was a lot that I could relate to. The language, as Rita Moreno, if you recall, Rita Moreno is a Hollywood actress who actually read the audio, would pronounce the words as I would hear them in my home. There's a song I will be playing for you. It's Cucurucuru Paloma, which is in the book, referred to in a time of grief. And it's a song that touches my heart because my father was a musician and we would listen to that song very often. As long as I can remember, we listened to that song. So a lot of parallels, a lot of interesting facts, but I think more than anything, I found Supreme Court Justice Sotomayor's story candid, very real, transparent. And so with the PowerPoint, I have about 15 slides or so. I may change and vary it a little bit as I recall parts of the book. But it's to give you an idea of how I recall and how I'm reviewing it and what kind of stood out in my mind. So it's an intimate story about mastering the unknown and facing challenges tenaciously and courageously. I think that the message was that there was never anything too difficult to learn. It was always a challenge, but in everything she learned throughout the book, what I read was that her interest was in learning, always seeing another perspective. Her writing is very intimate, intriguing and courageous, as I had mentioned, candid and very transparent. I think we got to know Sotomayor's childhood very well, difficulties, tragedies, grief, and very things that were celebrated throughout her life. In her words, she says, it's important to retell the stories that would paint the most authentic picture of my life experiences as a judge. And as the first Hispanic and third woman appointed to the United States Supreme Court, Sonia Sotomayor was sworn in on August 8, 2009 by Chief Justice John Roberts. President Obama commissioned Sotomayor on the day of her confirmation, and we read in her book about her experiences as a prosecutor with difficult cases of child abuse, white-collar crimes, and working as a private corporate lawyer, where her income grew drastically, but it was not the focus of why she did what she did as a professional. And then at age, of course, becoming a federal court judge. Her book is a memoir, and her life experiences, as she was explaining, put her in a vulnerable position. And she noted in her book that some readers might be disappointed by the fact that she wasn't writing more about adjudicated cases, about more details of her political view. And she starts off by noting that in the book, that it was more about her life stories, her memories as she recalled them. And she said, "I will be judged as a human being by what readers find here." A daughter of Puerto Rican immigrants, she always spoke about the love she had for her homeland, or her parents' homeland, the island of Puerto Rico, where she spent many summers throughout her childhood. And she recalls eating chinas, which are oranges, and mangoes. And she comes where she comes from, and as she does so, she speaks of it in eloquence and uses words that a reader can imagine as standing alongside her in her journey throughout life. In the book, in the prior to chapter one, there is a poem there that says, "To Puerto Rico I return." And it reads, "Forgive the exile, this sweet frenzy. I return to my beloved world, in love with the land where I was born." And that's by Jose Gautier Benitez. And in Spanish, as it's read, being born June 25th in 1954, she often goes back to Puerto Rico, of her experiences, of the foods. You can almost smell the scent of food cooking as she speaks of sofrito being cooked. And in her native tongue, it's "Perdonando el desterrado ese dulce frenesí, vuelvo a mi mundo adorado, y yo estoy enamorado de la tierra en que nací." Here in her adorable picture with her father Juan Sotomayor, who was born in 1921 from the area of Santurce, San Juan, Puerto Rico, and her mother Celina Baez, who was born in 1927 and was an orphan and was raised in the neighborhood of Santa Rosa in Lajas. And as we read, Sonia grew up with an alcoholic father and a mother who was emotionally distant. And we can find in the early chapters where she speaks of that distance, of lying next to her mother, which seemed like a log next to her, without that touch, that embrace that she so longed for. Throughout the book, we read that, and then it changes towards the end of the book. But always she has that story that she's sharing with us of wanting more, of wanting to have that love demonstrated to her and longing for that and not understanding her mother. And later she realizes that there is an opportunity to understand her mother. And also the maturity when her father died and she realized that maybe it was better that way because of all the chaos that went on within the household. As a child, she was diagnosed with diabetes, and she courageously and very maturely decided one day she was going to give herself her own injections, and she practiced giving injections into a china, an orange. And at some point, you read about when she made the decision, "I'm going to take care of this myself." At a very young age, she decided that, very determined, very self-driven. You can start to see and get a sense for her manner of taking care of things for herself and by herself oftentimes. But also she speaks of her brother, Junior, whom she still relates to as Junior, although he's a doctor, medical doctor now. But that relationship that was built between them and that bond that was created during those times of chaos in the household, where father would start acting awkwardly and she knew that it was time that they stay and keep their distance from the father, their father. And then the mother's yelling and the anger and the disappointment in that, the fact that her husband was an alcoholic. So by age 7, she started to inject herself with insulin. If you recall, her father attempted to, but he could not do it because his hands were trembling. Whether it was from fear or a combination of fear and alcoholism, it doesn't really note, but we know that at that point, perhaps, Sotomayor thought, "I need to do this for myself." And during those years, Sotomayor's mother was working. So father, if you recall, would take them for lunches, would cook for them, and she talks about the foods, the delicious foods that her father would cook for them. Selena, her mother, who had become part of the Women's Army Corps by age 19, then went on to become a nurse, and that really benefited Sotomayor. She speaks also in the book about remembering and fondly remembering when her mother, when she would have a drop in her sugar levels, so she would start to perspire, and her mother would come by her bedside and speak to her in a low tone of voice so as not to wake up Junior, but also in a way to put her hand on her back and get that cool washcloth, damp washcloth, and wipe her down and cool her off. So you can imagine and envision the warm nights and the discomfort, and yet the fact that Sotomayor's mother was comforting her at a time that she needed. And she also recalls and states that it was that her time with her mother. Junior was asleep, but this was the time that she longed for and really sought so often in her life. Abuelita. She speaks very fondly of her abuelita. Abuelita has a special place in Latino cultures, and she seemed to be the safe place for Sotomayor to go, to whether it was a meal or a chat or just being in her apartment, where she speaks of it being full of plants and flowers and vines that would reach up to the ceiling as to reach out towards the window. She recalls the plants that were all over the place, and she recalls those memories fondly, and how close they were. And then she also relates to us those moments where they were chased in the back room, and they sat around the table during a seance, and they would peek out and try to find out and see what was going on, knowing that they weren't permitted to be in there, but she was intrigued but also confused by it. So I thought that also spoke of her transparency and her vulnerability to put that out there for the reader. It's quite intriguing to me that she did that. And what her abuelita would always say to her in her sense of nurturing her: que Dios te bendiga, te favorezca, y te libra de todo mal y peligro. She would end her visit with her by saying these words. She was a strong and caring woman. Sotomayor recalls that very clearly. And Sotomayor loved being by her side. She speaks of going to el mercado to buy food, to prepare, she loved to have picnics. And so she would say, vamos a la parranda, let's go party. So she seemed to be a very lively woman. Mm-hmm. So, que Dios te bendiga, te favorezca, y te libra de todo mal y peligro is, may God deliver you from all evil and danger. So she felt closest to her grandmother and almost sought that bendición, that blessing from her grandmother. She noted that her grandmother gave her a source, was her source of protection and of purpose. Bronxdale housing. We can imagine by her, the way she writes eloquently about the noise, and at one point her adolescent years, she had some friends over and they were making noise and being rambunctious, and a neighbor called out and said, quiet those kids down. And the mother stood up for her and said, they're kids, my goodness, they're kids, they're going to make noise, leave them alone. And she relates that story almost like, mother came to my protection. Mother stood up for me, she advocated for me. And she also tells about other stories that happened while they were living in this housing unit. And in 1957 is when they moved into the well-maintained, racially and ethnically mixed working-class Bronxdale housing, as an aspect of the New York City Housing Authority. And they were built multiple stories, small areas, cramped, but they became communities. They got to know their neighbors, and that's where she spent many years throughout her pre-adolescent and adolescent years. She also tells about the stories going to visit her abuelita and then going back to the Bronx housing and the differences she would see and people she would talk to in the street. And she's, at one point she mentioned the story of someone who had to be carried down several stories and sat in front of the housing complex, and how she would greet this man on a regular basis, but that he would sit outside all day watching the goings on that were outdoors. And then by the end of the day, two workers would come home and carry the gentleman back up into his home. Strife and struggles at home. We read about this quite a bit in the initial part of the few chapters. Her brother Junior, she talks about the parties at her abuelita's house where there was lots of noise and music, and you get the sense that it was a noisy parties, but that it really was a place to be, a fun place to be and celebrate with friends. And she was always surrounded by relatives, nieces and nephews that she talks about endearingly. And she speaks of the food that was prepared, but she also speaks of when, at one point, when her father stepped into the party and everything changed. And it was just an awkward moment for her, because I think the embarrassment or the shame of what might dad do while he's here as we're having a good time. Now we move on a little bit into the aspect of her experience at Princeton and Yale. When she speaks of Princeton, which she got a full scholarship, there's discussion about affirmative action, conflict in perspectives on affirmative action with an attorney and the results of that. And I think in her approach, when she discussed affirmative action, it was more about distributive justice than being compensated somehow for her ethnic background. And I think in her defense, she talked about how she had earned her place at Princeton and Yale, and that it was not easy for her. It was difficult for her in even writing her first essay, but then that she sought out those whom she thought were very good students and always asked for help, for mentoring, or asked for help in how do you study, because she really wanted to master what she did not know. So the picture on your right is the 1976 Princeton yearbook picture. And it's interesting, the story she talks about at Princeton. While at Princeton, she heard about first time about the book Alice in Wonderland and was fascinated by that. So that kind of tells you the very different worlds that were coming together and kind of colliding for her. You know, Alice in Wonderland, it's like everybody knows what that is, but imagine going to Princeton and having no clue and hearing about it for the first time. How fascinating it must have been to read that book. And maybe seeing herself as Alicia in Wonderland. Her bicultural experiences of being acculturated to the life at the university and the various settings and environments at Princeton and Yale were fascinating. Her struggles, nothing was easy, but always set like that. Little girl who learned to say, I will give myself my own insulin injections. She said, I will take control of this, I will master it and move forward. She was the winner of the Pine Prize, the highest award Princeton gives to a senior, as well as graduated summa cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa. Not easy tasks. And she writes about how surprised she was when she got the call with the news, like, how am I supposed to feel, and what does this really mean? And I've never heard of that before. It sounds like something pretty good. So it was that affirmation that I must be doing really well. Because throughout the book, you read about her self-doubt. Can I do it? Am I smart enough? And we also read about her sense of fashion, or no sense of fashion, where her mother would say, oh, that looks nice, but why didn't you do your nails? There was always the but. And so she struggled trying to figure out what to wear. She writes about buying a jacket, and I'm assuming it's the jacket here to your left, because she speaks of the white jacket where they went to the fancy store that they never go shopping at. They bought this white jacket, and she wore it year after year after year. So frugal, aware of the blessings that were coming her way, not a lot of attention to fashion. So as I mentioned, she was challenged by self-doubt, as her mother did. Her mother often, she tells of her mother's story about taking the nursing exam and fretting over it, being sick over it, just thinking, I'm not smart enough, I can't do this, and yet she passed. I touched upon it a little bit, but her struggles with diabetes, another part that I thought was very candid and very open about her experiences, but also open to the point where she stated that her mother didn't know about those incidences she had where she lost consciousness or her sugar level dropped so quickly because she was trying to control it, as she often talks about eating certain fruits or foods or maybe not having eaten on time or not enough. So you get the sense that she's always monitoring that, the blood sugar levels and what she ate and what she didn't, and being mindful of that. And even though she gave it her best and I would say mastered that, that there were times when it was out of her control as she was changing, even hormonally, she talks about the changes where that had to impact, or whether there was high levels of stress or grief or a trauma that would affect her diabetes. She gave herself, beginning at age 8, 3 shots of insulin a day. Self-reliant and resourceful, she figured out she may not live as long as most people. She thought about that at an early age, and so she thought she had no time to waste. She wanted to get things done. She wanted to meet some goals. And that's very evident about the way she lived her life and how she studied law and why she's a Supreme Court Justice today. She actually mentioned that if it weren't for passersby or friends that knew about her diabetes, that she would not be here today. She tells of a story where she made good friends with the Fendi family from Italy, I believe, and they were in Venice, actually. And she was in her hotel room, and some of the Fendis were waiting for her. She didn't show up on time, so they went up to the concierge and said, "We need to go find out what's going on," and they didn't want to allow them in. So they said they about beat down the door, but they eventually got in to see her, and she was in a semi-conscious state. So, of course, in Venice, she said the ambulance was a boat, and that the way they carried her out was pretty much on a chair with some poles. But she spent a couple days or so, I think, in the hospital in Venice. And at that point, she, again, taking charge, was trying to show the physician how to use her meter to, you know, decide what her sugar levels were at, and the doctor said, no, I'm the doctor here. So he had his own way of figuring that out. And the fact that she carried something in her purse that says, "I am not drunk, I am unconscious or acting strangely, I may have low blood sugar." And at one point where she was, I forget where she was, but the syringes and insulin fell out of her purse, and an officer asked about it, and you can almost sense the nervousness, like, you know, in the Bronx with syringes and, you know, what's that? The assumption could be that there's something more other than insulin, and she said she was grateful she was not arrested because that definitely would have affected her pathway to the Supreme Court Justice. She was tenacious about everything she did. Or does, I should say. She said, "There's something to learn even in boiling water, and there's something to learn from everyone." And she speaks of being invited to Yankee Stadium to throw out the ball, and that she practiced for 20 minutes for several weeks just to learn how to pitch the ball. I mean, that's tenacity and that's determination. She wanted to make sure she was doing it right. But it also shows her sense of humor. It shows her ability to have fun. And that was also demonstrated in when she would gather with her friends. She speaks a lot of dear friends and how they really helped her through some very difficult times. She speaks of the divorce with Kevin, her high school sweetheart, and that if she had figured it out later, but if it hadn't been for her friends taking her out every weekend to go shopping, that she probably would have had a more difficult time when the marriage ended. But she also speaks humorously about her friend in the dressing room laughing at the things she was trying on. Throughout the book, she speaks of her nieces and nephews, babies. She also speaks frankly about choosing not to have children. And here's a picture where you can see that she's with her nephews on your left, and I really enjoyed the picture on the upper right because it shows her sense of humor. And what she would say about her nieces and nephews, even as I grew to be young adults, she would say, "I need a hug. And whenever you see me, I could use a hug. Because again, still, even as an adult, she was longing for that touch, that embrace. And so they got into a habit and a pattern of hugging her whenever they saw her. And she, if you see her information, even on internet, she's often reading to children at children's libraries and a mentor for children. Her community service, she worked at a hospital, and at the hospital she learned of the difficulties of people's lives. She learned of the difficulty when no interpreters are part of an institution or a medical facility. She set out to change things at times within systems to benefit all. And there was a point at which one of her friends, Dolores, played the guitar. And of the time when they decided at the hospital to set up a Christmas event. And so they invited patients and staff and people to come to the event. And Dolores played the song Cucuru Paloma. So I'm going to play that for you. If it comes up too loudly, Deborah, you might want to turn it down. This song is very, very old. I would say late 30s, 40s, a favorite in our household. And the song really is about talking about grief and loss. The words are beautiful. I will read a few of them to you as you listen to it. Lola Beltran, a very famous singer who sang in the very kind of a Baroque style. She sang it, and if you can hear it in her voice, that she's almost crying, or you could hear the sound in her tone of voice that it's a sound of pain and sorrow. And when Rita Moreno, she kind of sings a few little lines there in the book. Dicen que por las noches no más se le iba un puro llorar. They say that every night he was wholly overtaken by tears. Dicen que no comía ni más se le iba en puro tomar. They say he never ate, but only drank. Juran que el mismo cielo se estremecía al oír su llanto. They say he never ate, but only drank, and they swear that even the heavens trembled to hear his wail. He suffered for her so, that even in death he never stopped calling her. Ay, 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 cantaba. He would sing of passion, tormented by fatal passion. They say that in early morning a sad dove sings to the little empty house with its wide open little doors. They swear that the dove is none other than his spirit. Que todavía espera a que regrese la desdichada. Hoping still for the return of the ill-fated woman, cucuru cucu, paloma, dove, little dove, do not weep anymore.
Que por las noches no más se le iba en puro llorar. Dicen que no dormía, no más se le iba en puro tomar. Juran que el mismo cielo se estremecía al oír su llanto. Cómo sufrió por ella, que hasta en su muerte la fue llamando. Thank you.
Okay, that gives you an idea.
Beautiful song. So, Supreme Court Judge Sonia Sotomayor, she speaks about still finding her voice. She speaks about learning about who she is, about the principles that matter to her, and principles that don't go beyond reasoning. She talks about having passionate discussions with other human beings and about the pull and the tug of perspective, of ways of thinking, of ways of seeing the world, and her passion for wanting to listen to other voices and learn from every person she speaks to, even those that criticize her. I'd like to read to you just towards the end of the book where she's actually being sworn in, and President Obama is looking in her direction, and she says, of course she speaks about her mother when her mother just continues to cry and how proud her mother is and how they actually got to the point where they built a relationship based on understanding, and how she reached out to her mother and how she understood the anger that her mother had and the difficulty living with her father and the difficulty that it was to learn and to study and to receive her nurse licensure. So they come to a point where they now have a healthy relationship. They understand each other. Mother remarried, was excited for her. They celebrated what Sotomayor sought after as a little girl, to decide to become a judge. And always thinking about where she came from, where her roots are from, what she learned from every family member and every friend, the tenacity through the challenges and mastering what she did not know. It's a story that's frank, honest, and again, told so eloquently that you really get to know who she is as a woman, and that she doesn't stop being who she is even as a Supreme Court justice. She says, "Then I caught the eye of the president sitting in the first row and felt gratitude bursting inside me. An overwhelming gratitude unrelated to politics or position, a gratitude alive with Abuelita's joy, and with a sudden memory, an image as seen through the eyes of a child." You can almost envision her going back to Puerto Rico and thinking about her time with her Abuelita. She says, "I was running back to the house in Mayagüez with a melting ice cone we walked and we called a piragua, running sweet and sticky down my face and arms, the sun in my eyes, breaking through clouds and glinting off the rain-soaked pavement and dripping leaves. I was running with joy, an overwhelming joy that arose simply from gratitude for the fact of being alive. Along with the image, memory carried these words from a child's mind through time. I am blessed. In this life, I am truly blessed." Thank you. Are there any questions from the audience or comments? What you enjoyed from the book or things you took away from the book? Yes, please. At the beginning of the book, she speaks about the many questions that she has been receiving. Why did you choose this route? Were there challenges you faced? And she also speaks about wanting children with diabetes not to feel like there's a limitation as to what they can do, but they can live a full life in choosing to live their dream. So she speaks about that before chapter one, where she speaks about that it was a calling, it was something that she found necessary deep within her to tell her story and from her own memory, and the risk that she felt she was taking by putting the information out there. Even related at one point where she said, my mother's going to read about this for the first time in the book. So feeling a little awkward about that. Thank you. Yes.
Most Supreme Court justices keep an extremely low profile, and I've been struck with her. I mean, she did the 60-minute interview, she did the gay marriage thing, she's on a lecture tour, She's not doing that.
No, very contrary, and I think that has been some of the comments made in some of the literature and magazines, that it's so different than what Supreme Court justices tend to do, which is write very conservatively about their lives. And one of the things that impressed me about the book was just how real she made her story. She didn't hold back at all. I would read some chapters going, when I was listening to it on tape, heading to work, I would burst out laughter going, oh my gosh, I can't believe she said that or she shared that. You know, and I could hear myself audibly going, oh, you know. So it, you know, again, I think it speaks to her courage. It speaks to her openness and her authenticity, which for me is that's what I took away from it, is that you can be who you are and still be a leader and still address some pretty powerful and provocative social issues.
And I wonder if it will change the deportment of the Supreme Court, especially in future nominations.
I can't help but think it might. It surely is a shift. Thank you for the question. And then there's one back. Yes.
Two questions. One is, I have high school and middle school daughters, and any reason that you wouldn't recommend that the book to them? And then a second question, you mentioned affirmative action, which I thought was interesting, and I wondered if there's much more of that sort of speaking directly about any law that, you know, that might, and how it might have affected her personal life.
I believe affirmative action definitely provided the opportunity, it was distributive justice, and that's my opinion, that there is an opportunity here from underrepresented groups. And you still have to prove yourself. You still have to show and demonstrate that you can meet whatever it is you're working towards. But it's that opportunity for equity. I think it, and she does speak of how it had a direct impact on her and her brother Jr., because her brother Jr. actually, through affirmative action, was able to begin on a track to become a medical doctor, but it was based on affirmative action. And then she also challenges an attorney who questioned her ability to be in a pretty prestigious law, law firm, thank you. All right, firm. A law firm questioning whether or not it was simply based on the open door affirmative action. So it was interesting how she pursued that for the sake of justice in her own mind, also to call attention to that injustice. As far as recommending it to middle school and high school, I have four children who are all grown, and when they would come home and tell me what they would hear at school, I would say, yes, I would recommend it. Because the context is so rich, and I think it would generate questions from that age group about what about this and what about that, instead of coming home with some stories that we say, oh, Lord help me, how do I explain this one? So I always felt that they, at that age, they hear all kinds of craziness and some factual that need to have discussion while in the home, and I think it's a great way to have that occur. Great question, thank you. I have we have six grandchildren, and our 17-year-old granddaughter is coming with us. We're packing as we leave this event. We are taking 88 first-generation university students, most of children of immigrant families, to Chicago, to the United States Hispanic Leadership Institute. Three intense days of training where they have to be in business attire, and it's a fascinating process. I see them as leaders. I would recommend the book to them. Yes, Deborah.
What sorts of things in your own experience led you to relate to this book so much?
Oh, so much. I think I was telling you, Deborah, that as I would listen to the book, I'd get to work because I travel from here to downtown Salem. I would get there, and it was all of a sudden, oh, I'm at work. You know, it would just happen like that because I was really living in the moment. the words, el español, the way Rita Moreno would state it, it was almost like Sotomayor was saying, sharing the story with me. Alcoholic father, the worry about siblings. I'm the oldest of 10, oldest female of 10, so lots of siblings. Those kind, and the level of acculturation that she was sensing, the bicultural aspect, going to college, foreign, very foreign to me. And so a lot of experiences, when she literally spoke of habichuelas en arroz, you know, I'm like, I could smell the pot of beans cooking. It was just that much alive for me. So a lot of connections. And also, as I was reading it, affirmative action, it's been a discussion at the Oregon Youth Authority right now. It's a presentation that we're giving. We're having discussions about what that means and really an educational process of what it means and what it doesn't mean. So it's just very real for me. I really wanted to thank you both for the opportunity. It really was a highlight for me this year. Yes, please.
I like what she said in the book about affirmative action. She doesn't really say yay or nay on it. She simply says it might have gotten me in the door, but I was the one to fix it myself.
Yes.
She had to be right. Princeton's too incredibly tough to get into, and so. And I think Princeton is the kind of college that's not going to let you in simply because you are a minority. You've got to have something on the ball, and I think they saw that in her. And like she said, she had to. She still had to justify it. She had to stay in, and she did.
And she did, and she would talk about the long days of studying and on the, I remember it was the train or the subway, but she spent all day at it at times and struggling through it and taking homework home even when she was with her mom. So yes, I think, you know, I did appreciate that it wasn't a book about her about politics. It was about the way she sees the world and really that childhood desire that she accomplished beyond her dreams. So when she speaks of looking at the eyes of the president and watching her mother cry and just like, I'm going to pinch myself. Is this really happening to me? So, and that she speaks about, she continues to find her voice as a Supreme Court justice. Yes.
Maria, Sonia is very careful to avoid talking about this issue, but I hope you feel free to talk about it. What sort of consequences could there be having a Latina on the Supreme Court and other Latinos in the judicial system?
You recall in the book that she was referred to as the B word at times, and she was also referred to as a brassy Jewish woman. And she's Roman Catholic, which, by the way, all Supreme Court justices are Roman Catholic currently. No?
Three? Jewish.
Really?
Yes.
I must have misread the information. So three are Jewish.
And only one is from west of the Mississippi.
Ah, okay. We have somebody who knows.
How representative is that?
Thank you for clarifying. Back to your question, Kayla. I think it can perpetuate stereotypes. If you recall the questions that existed about whether or not she can keep her emotions in check, you know, is the stereotype that Latinas are loud and boisterous like me? it could perpetuate stereotypes, but also I think the challenge right now I see is the demographic conversion occurring in this country. I'm not sure what it means. I worry. I guess what I feel when you ask that question is I worry. I become concerned. And then I think about this incredibly powerful, capable woman. I think she can handle anything that comes at her, which she has proven to do so already just in prior to becoming the Supreme Court Justice. She prepared. She talked about having people interview her. She felt good about how she was responding to all the questions coming at her when she's been challenged. So I think her record indicates that she can handle whatever comes her way.
Yes, please.
Yeah, in the book, does she indicate any things that she would characterize as weaknesses that she's trying to improve?
Hmm.
I could say it a different way.
Okay.
What's the bad part about it?
About the book itself?
No, no, about Sonia.
Having a tough time thinking about it. Certainly, maybe being too certain, maybe being too self-assured. But she does speak about that passion for the pull and the tug, where she needs to hear. She does talk about principles quite a bit, and she talks about not letting that overrule reasoning, the power of reasoning. And perhaps the influence of others on the Supreme Court. There's got to be a tremendous amount of public pressure and expectation, and equally so, disappointment in some of her rulings. And how do you mediate that? And yet she talks about this is her dream. And in her previous jobs as a prosecutor and working for the law firm, she speaks of loving that challenge. So, I can't think of anything else other than, of course, you know, the medical diabetes is very much affected by stress, and she has an incredibly stressful job. Probably something she just, oh, and she did speak about being in the public eye and how challenging that has been. Thank you for your question. I struggled through that one. Any other questions? Yes, please, and then over here.
I just want to thank you for the beautiful view, for the music, and your background. It's just really, and I read the book, and I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you very much. It really is a pleasure. It really is a pleasure. When I was invited, I was like, how am I going to do this? Because I was switching from one job to the next, and Deborah did a good job of finding me as my emails were no longer good. And she's like, oh, there you are. I found you. So thank you for your persistence in that. But I really struggled with, am I going to be able to give the book justice? How do you like that one? Okay, we had one more question I didn't want to ignore, and then we will commence.
I really enjoyed this book a great deal, but one of the things that I think she is so impressive for is how, as a Supreme Court Justice, how she's so comfortable being in the public eye. So she was, you know, the one that got to drop the ball at Times Square on New Year's Eve. She was one of the presenters at the Kennedy Center Honors Program. She introduced the Latino opera singer Martina Arroyo, and she was so affable and comfortable being in the public eye, and I don't know any other justices who are so comfortable just being public.
She demonstrates what we call simpatia, or simpatia. It is that comfortable way of being diplomatic and courteous, and I think that demonstrates her love of human beings from all walks of life. She seems intrigued by human beings, and really I think perhaps because she has diabetes, maybe not, perhaps because of her challenges, maybe not, but she seems to just love life every day, whatever comes at her and the accomplishments. And you see that, I think, in the way she lives her life. She's happy. She's joyous. And maybe she gets that from her abuelita. She does speak about her abuelita being joyful. Thank you again for your time.
This is a high school English teacher.